This is Charlie.
Hi Charlie, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking some time to talk about Eternal Sunshine.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I saw it the other week and absolutely positively loved it.
Oh, good. Thanks.
First question I have for you guys is this movie is a really a genre-defying movie. It's not sci-fi, it's not drama, it's not romantic comedy. How do you get a film like this made nowadays that doesn't fit neatly into a genre box?
I don't know. We sold it as, we sold it several years ago as a pitch. And we sold it to somebody who I think we both trusted and liked, a guy named Steve Golan, who at the time ran Propaganda. So I think I don't know. I can't speak for Michelle, but I trusted that he was gonna, he got the idea and was gonna let the movie be made the way it should be. But there were a lot of people interested in the story, so. It wasn't a particularly hard sell, as an idea.
Now, you guys, you.
I think maybe she said I could add. I think the way the speech could allow people to believe it would be like a science fiction. Or, I mean, we.
I think people thought more. It was like, oh, I mean, what I remember hearing a lot is, oh, it's a new way to tell a romance, a love story. It's a new version of that. I think that was the.
But they could have different ways to visualize the film, like very technical, very spectacular, or more character driven.
Yeah, I mean, the way I describe it is, you've seen When Harry Met Sally, this is like When Harry Forgets Sally. So, but it, an interesting choice, I mean, because, maybe one of the things that keeps it from being kind of classed as sci-fi is that, you place it when in a place that feels a lot like the present. What went into deciding when and where to place this film?
I think we knew. I think Michelle and I were in agreement from the beginning that it should be the science fiction aspect of it should be really played down, and that it should be as sort of realistic, a company and as sort of mundane a company as possible. That was more interesting, and it was sort of would focus. I think in my mind anyway, would focus the story on the relationship and that aspect of it rather than the sort of technological aspect of it, which I don't think was real interesting to us.
Was there influence at all by films that preceded it to deal with memory, like Nolan's Memento or Verhoeven's Recall?
No, in fact, we pitched this idea several years before Chris Nolan came out with his movie. So I was delayed in writing it because I had to write the movie that became Adaptation first, and then I was producing Human Nature, which Michelle was directing. So, and plus it was very hard to write for me. So there was a moment when suddenly Memento, people started talking about this movie Memento, when I totally freaked out because I thought, oh, I can't do this anymore. And I called Michelle and said I'm not doing it. And we called Steve Golan and said we're not doing it. And Steve Golan was very angry and said, you are doing it. And so we did it. But yeah, I mean, I mean, I so I had no, I wasn't influenced by Memento except in that way. And I have never seen Total Recall, but I've read a lot of Philip K. Dick stories and books, and I don't think that was a direct influence on this, but I certainly like his work.
Anytime you use anything that kind of fractures a story, how do you ensure that the story that's being fractured, is maintained and has, you've done a wonderful job of having this great story about these two people, yet it gets fractured in memory and time and so on and so forth. Do you write the story of those people first and then figure out how it all fits together, or does it get assembled as you write it?
I think it gets assembled in some form as I write it. I don't write the separate stories. I have some idea about where different stories might be going, where the Mary and Stan story might be going from scene to scene. But I don't write piecemeal like that because the two things are kind of informing each other. The different stories are all to just write piecemeal seems a little bit like it might end up being kind of a clinical thing when it's done. And then I turn in the script, and then Michelle and the producers have suggestions about about things, and then the script gets changed, and then the movie gets shot, and then in editing, a lot of stuff gets moved around, gets shifted around, and refined even more, you know, to sort of create different tone and you know, either more complexity or less complexity as need be in different places.
How much shuffling was done in post-production? The kind of word on the street was that this got moved to the March release because of the intense complexity of post-production.
No, I mean, I don't know. I think it's, I don't know. Maybe Michelle could talk to that.
It's funny that the couple of times we hear that the editing was long, but I don't think we delayed the process.
I kind of feel like we edited longer because we were given more time because we moved it. You know,
we
used the time. I don't think that we were told this isn't. I mean, you know, I didn't hear that going. You know, during the time.
Because I think they would. If they wanted to open at any time, they would say, okay, you have to finish for this day.
Well, they did originally. They told us, remember, they said it has to be done for November, and we rushed to get it done, and then they didn't release it. So, I mean, it ended up being a good thing, I think. We did, I think having more time was a good thing for us, you know.
Can you, by curiosity, can you tell us how you got this information?
Oh, it's just, you know, obviously that it was a highly anticipated release, so there was a lot of chatter on film boards and such, and so, you know, when it moved from, you know, kind of Oscar time, you know, Oscar contention time to March, you know, there was obviously wide speculation, probably between people who don't know anything and, you know, people who know enough to be dangerous. But it's good to know that, you know, that extra time gave you, you know, more time to be able to sharpen the film, because I think it's, you know, it's amazingly put together.
It is a weird thing to look at those film board things, because they, I mean, I have seen things about this movie and other movies that are just sort of patently untrue. You know, they're just, you know, and it's all in the form, I guess it's in the form of speculation. Why, you know, why wide release? And then there's like, you know, 500 people talking about what the implications of a wide release are, and it's just, but talking, you know, as if they have any kind of inside information. And you know, having inside information, or at least to a certain extent having it, it's amazing how much they don't know, you know?
Right. Well, it's refreshing. You're a man of very few interviews that I've seen, so it's great to get the word on what's really happening from the men themselves.
Yeah, well, I do interviews.
You've kind of developed a slight, I mean, and perhaps, you know, it's kind of interesting dichotomy between you know, putting a character of yourself in adapting a film on screen, and you know, and then having, you know, a separation of being a writer, writing about yourself, putting it on screen. But obviously, that's another movie. Except that one of the questions I had is you know, are there parallels between adaptations Charlie Kaufman and Eternal Sunshine's Joel Barish?
you know, I wrote both guys, and to a certain extent, I have no choice but to sort of draw on my own life experience and my own personality when I create characters. And so, I you know, I'm sure that there are similarities, and then I think that, you know, anytime you write anything, it's gonna be autobiographical. So because you wrote it, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. So I'm sure that there are similarities, but, you know, the different character and the film is different, and the actor is obviously different, which I think does a lot to sort of, you know, bring a character to life. I think that, you know, so.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty amazing choice to have, you know, a very extroverted, exuberant, you know, a comedic actor play a role of a very restrained, introspective, and introverted character. How did the process happen with Jim Carrey getting selected for the film, and you know, and what kind of effect did that have once he joined the project?
Well, the character was existing, and when we learned that Jim was interested to do the film, I mean, we got excited by it. It was interesting that the fact that he's like is so removed from what I read on the paper was challenging. And I mean, as I said before, I like the fact that he doesn't have the coolness of most of Hollywood actors. Was really interesting for me. I mean, all his energy that he needs to spend in most of his role, he had to keep it inside, and maybe that gave him some intensity. And I tried to keep him off balance as much as I could. Sometimes we'd roll the camera at the wrong time, and I would give like the wrong order at the last minute just to create a little panic, which I do in general as well with extra, because otherwise they just become like robots. So I think by putting him off balance, and he had physical stuff to do, but that was not plastic. That made him forget about what he should do to be the character, and he became the character by the force of things.
Yeah. Also, bringing Kate Winslet to the table, it was interesting that many people may not see this, but it seemed like she's cast kind of against type as well. Was she brought in terms of chemistry to carry? Was the process to find a match between the two leads? How did that all come about?
Well, I think it was to find the best Clementine. That's what I think. I don't know, but,
Yeah, it was to find the best Clementine as well. I don't know. It seems to be good to have her facing Jim. I mean, in a way, she gave us a guarantee that we would do a movie that would not be only about two big stars. Although she's a famous person, but she has a quality of being a ruler that it's somehow hard to find in actresses, in very big, very famous actresses. And to us, it was really a guarantee that we would do a movie about Clementine and Joel, not about Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey.
And I think you're really successful in that vein. They definitely get lost in the characters, and I think as a viewer, you get lost in them rather than being aware of who they are outside of the screen. One of the things about this film and other films that you guys have done is that they often challenge the viewer not just to kind of sit back and let it come to you, but kind of to put pieces together, to follow along, to be an active kind of participant in putting the story together mentally. Is there ever concern that you might go down a rabbit hole that would lose the audience, or how do you, when you're making a film like this, know where the threshold is of where you can go?
I'm not sure you do. I mean, you kind of do what feels right for the story and what feels exciting to you, and then you see, and then you experiment, and we showed it to people who aren't familiar, at different stages with the story, and sort of gauge their reaction to different things. And we're not I don't think we were ever afraid of confusing people or losing people. We wanted them we hoped that they would enjoy that, the process of trying to figure things out, and that was sort of, but yeah, the idea that you're not exactly handing things to people was I think always kind of part of the game plan.
And that's right. I mean, it's important we're not trying to outsmart them or show that, it's complex and they have to be smart to understand the film. We just, as a director, I like to do a film that feels like a ride, and therefore you don't want to know exactly where you're going. You want to get surprises and confusion in a way that you want to know what's happening, and then you get excited about it. Not in a way that, oh, that this movie is smart, so I better figure it out, or I'm an idiot. Mm-hmm.
So, Michel, you've done a lot of work in your videos with, patterns and repetition and such. Were there themes that you explored in this film that, that in a greater context that you've been, visiting in some of your video work?
The premise was allowing to go into that, and I think the goal was to find a way to use this kind of work on pattern, but in an invisible way, just in a way that will help the story and the character to make this. And I think this quality exists in all Charlie's scripts. the geometrical aspect. On me, it's not like, it's not jumping in your face. But when I read his script, I have very good satisfaction because he satisfies my need for geometry on complex organization or chaos. It may be the same.
Yeah, there were elements of in the film where that made me think back to the "Come Into My World" video that you did with Kylie Minogue, of elements kind of coming in and going out, and I definitely saw some parallels there. Kind of a film geek question, film trivia question. Going back and setting Lacuna on 11th Ave, which you used for Malkovich. Is that something that just kind of happened? Is that something that was intentional? How did that come about?
Is that in the movie? Is it apparent in the movie, or was that from the script?
Apparently, this is another one of these film geek kind of, hey, we realize that this building is the same building from Being John Malkovich.
In the script, I stuck it in the same building. I don't think in the movie it's anywhere near it. I mean, I think that the location, obviously the building is completely different, so it's not even the same style of building. And I don't think it appears in the movie. Anywhere in the movie does it indicate that it's in that address. But I did that for fun, for myself.
Now, I mean, is there a sense that kind of leads to, was there a sense of connection between some of the things that you dealt with in Malkovich in this film? Do you see these films being connected in any way?
Well, I mean, there's elements of being inside someone's head, subjective experience and that sort of thing, I guess. There's some not supernatural, but fantastic sort of situations in both movies. And other than that, I don't know. That's maybe for critics to speculate about.
Now, is there anything that we can look forward to, that from the film that's not in the film once it comes to DVD? In terms of abandoned storylines or deleted scenes or commentaries is there anything that you guys are looking at when this gets presented?
I certainly haven't had any conversations with anybody about the DVD, so I don't know if Michelle has, but I don't know.
No, I don't know yet.
But
the film is what it is now. I'm not sure we want to make a different film, or maybe some extra, I don't know. We're kind of focusing on the film on the big screen now.
Definitely. One of the reasons why I asked is it seems to be a film that, after seeing it was one of those ones where I went, God, I want to see this again. I feel like I learned so much towards the end of the story that I'd want to go back and revisit it. So it seems like this is the kind of movie that plays very well in an environment where you can revisit parts and go back and see it over and over again.
I think it's really designed to be seen more than once because there's information you don't get that you don't have at the beginning of the movie that does not allow you to completely understand certain scenes. You can understand them as Joel and Clementine. For example, you don't know that they've met each other before. They know each other when they meet on the train, and that seeing that scene, I mean, seems interesting to me anyway, in theory, to sort of get to see that scene again once you know that,
It would be interesting, actually, because I remember when I was young, the movie were played in loop, and sometimes I would go in the middle of the film and just leave when you would just recognize a part you've seen before, and then you would say, okay, I finished the film,
right,
in a kind of arbitrary way, but that was interesting. And maybe we should sometimes do a screening in loop, where people would come anytime they want and leave anytime they want and see what it does,
okay,
in the box office. We do $1 million.
I would be in line for that one.
Okay.
So what's next for you guys? What projects are you working on next?
I'm just writing something new. It's very very early stages. That's it.
Michelle?
Well, I've done some videos lately, and I wrote a story that more about myself, and try to direct it. Put it in production.
Now, Michelle, you're continuing on with some of your music video work?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
That seems to be an anomaly. Many music video directors kind of, they use it as a proving ground and then go on. It seems like there's a small group, obviously you included, that continue to work in that space. What do music videos give for feature film directors, while they're not making feature films?
I always like to experiment. And I'm very often I wake up or I have an idea in my shower, per se, it's an idea that fits perfectly for a music video, and it's like an idea. And I think to me, music video is a perfect medium to do kinetic, I don't know if it's the correct word, or geometrical research, and I use them for that. I mean, and I think I do a job for the song as well by doing that. So I would never stop doing those.
Yeah, it's nice to see that your collected works are available on DVD and being able to kind of sit through and see the progression of what you've done in that space. It's interesting that, you know, with you and Spike Jonze and Chris Cunningham doing this kind of work, it's nice to get some attention for some of the very creative stuff that's going on in a space that people may not recognize.
Okay.
Last question for Charlie. Is there any word, there's been a lot of talk about adaptation and a special edition and so on and so forth. Do you have any updates on that, any news in that space?
I don't really. I mean, I know they're working on it, and I'm not really sure when it's definitely going to be out, and there's some cool stuff on it. But I can't tell you exactly when.
Do you think you'll ever reunite with your brother to do another screenplay?
I probably not. I think that's been done.
Well, thank you both for your time. Again, really enjoyed Spotless Mind. It's definitely the kind of film that bears watching over and over again, and I'm looking forward to its formal release so I can get yet again see it again.
Oh, thanks a lot. I'm glad you liked it. It was nice to talk to you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.